Chapter 26. Your nation is called in question. Please to remember that it is the American press which glories in announcing that you are prepared to be rogues. And when this war has drained uncounted hundreds of millions more out of the United States exchequer, will they be richer, or more inclined to pay debts, or less willing to evade them, or more popular with their creditors, or more likely to get money from men whom they deliberately announce that they will cheat? I have not followed the Herald on the toneship question. That great naval victory appears to me not less horrible and wicked than suicidal. Block the harbors forever. Destroy the inlets of the commerce of the world. Perish cities, so that we may wreak an injury on them. It is the talk of madmen, but not the less wicked. The act injures the whole republic. But it is perpetrated. It is to deal harm to ages hence, but it is done. The Indians of old used to burn women and their unborn children. This stone ship business is Indian warfare. And it is performed by men who tell us every week that they are at the head of civilization, and that the old world is decrepit, and cruel, and barbarous as compared to theirs. The same politicians who throttle commerce at its neck, and threaten to confiscate trust money, say that when the war is over, and the South is subdued, then the turn of the old country will come, and a direful retribution shall be taken for our conduct. This has been the cry all through the war. He should have conquered the South, says an American paper which I read this very day, but for England. Was there ever such puling heard from men who have an army of a million, and who turn, and revile a people who have stood as aloof from their contest as we have from the War of Troy? Or is it an outcry made with malice prepense? And is the song of the New York Times a variation of the Herald tune? He conduct of the British in folding their arms and taking no part in the fight, has been so base, that it has caused the prolongation of the war, and occasioned a prodigious expense on our part. Therefore, as we have British property in our hands, we see. The lamb troubled the water dreadfully, and the wolf, in a righteous indignation, confiscated him. Of course we have heard that at an undisturbed time Great Britain would never have dared to press its claim for redress. Did the United States wait until we were at peace with France, before they went to war with us last? Did Mr. Seward yield the claim which he confesses to be just, until he himself was menaced with war? How long were the Southern gentlemen kept in prison? What caused them to be set free? And did the Cabinet of Washington see its error before or after the demand for redress? *** The captor was feasted at Boston, and the captives in prison hard by. If the wrongdoer was to be punished, it was Captain Wilkes who ought to have gone into limbo. At any rate, as the Cabinet of Washington could not give its approbation to the commander of the San Jacinto, why were the men not sooner set free? To sit at the Tremont House, and hear the captain after dinner give his opinion on international law, would have been better sport for the prisoners than the grim Sallee manger at Fort Warren. *t the beginning of December the British fleet on the West Indian station mounted 850 guns, and comprised 5 liners, 10 first-class frigates, and 17 powerful corvettes. In little more than a month the fleet available for operations on the American shore had been more than doubled. The reinforcements prepared at the various dockyards included 2 line of battleships, 29 magnificent frigates such as the Shannon, the Sutlej, the Euryalus, the Orlando, the Galatea, 8 corvettes armed like the frigates in part, with 140-pounder Armstrong guns, and the 2 tremendous iron-cased ships, the Warrior and the Black Prince, and their smaller sisters the Resistance and the Defense. There was work to be done which might have delayed the commission of a few of these ships for some weeks longer, but if the United States had chosen war instead of peace, the blockade of their coasts would have been supported by a steam fleet of more than 60 splendid ships, armed with 1,800 guns, many of them of the heaviest and most effective kind. Saturday Review, Jan. 11. I read in the commercial news brought by the Etonia, and published in London on the present 13th January, that the pork market was generally quiet on the 29th December last, that lard, though with more activity, was heavy and decidedly lower, and at Philadelphia, whiskey is steady and stocks firm. Stocks are firm. That is a comfort for the English holders, and the confiscating process recommended by the Herald is at least deferred. But presently comes an announcement which is not quite so cheering. The Saginaw Central Railway Company, let us call it, has postponed its January dividend on account of the disturbed condition of public affairs. A Le Bon Heur. The bond and shareholders of the Saginaw must look for loss and depression in times of war. This is one of war's dreadful taxes and necessities, and all sorts of innocent people must suffer by the misfortune. The corn was high at Waterloo when 150,000 men came and trampled it down on the Sabbath morning. There was no help for that calamity, and the Belgian farmers lost their crops for the year. Perhaps I am a farmer myself, an innocent colonist, and instead of being able to get to church with my family, have to see squadrons of French dragoons thundering upon my barley, and squares of English infantry forming and trampling all over my oats. By the way, in writing of panics, an ingenious writer in the Atlantic magazine says that the British panics at Waterloo were frequent and notorious. Well, I am a Belgian peasant, and I see the British running away, and the French cutting the fugitives down. What have I done, that these men should be kicking down my peaceful harvest for me, on which I counted to pay my rent, to feed my horses, my household, my children? It is hard. But it is the fortune of war. But suppose the battle over, the Frenchman says, "You scoundrel, why did you not take a part with me? And why did you stand like a double-faced traitor looking on? I should have won the battle but for you. And I hereby confiscate the farm you stand on, and your family may go to the workhouse." The New York press holds this argument over English people in terrorem. E Americans may be ever so wrong in the matter in dispute, but if you push us to a war, we will confiscate your English property. Very good. It is peace now. Confidence, of course, is restored between us. Our 1800 peace commissioners have no occasion to open their mouths, and the little question of confiscation is postponed. Messrs. Battery, Broadway, and Company, of New York, have the kindness to sell my Saginaws for what they will fetch. I shall lose half my loaf very likely, but for the sake of a quiet life, let us give up a certain quantity of farinaceous food. And half a loaf, you know, is better than no bread at all. The Notch on the Axe. Astoria La Mode. Part I, everyone remembers in the fourth book of the immortal poem of your blind bard, to whose sightless orbs no doubt glorious shapes were apparent, and visions celestial, how Adam discourses to Eve of the bright visitors who hovered round their Eden, millions of spiritual creatures walk the earth, unseen, both when we wake, and when we sleep. How often, says Father Adam, from the steep of echoing hill or thicket, have we heard celestial voices to the midnight air, soul, or responsive to each other's notes, singing? After the act of disobedience, when the erring pair from Eden took their solitary way, and went forth to toil and trouble on common earth, though the glorious ones no longer were visible, you cannot say they were gone. It was not that the bright ones were absent, but that the dim eyes of rebel man no longer could see them. In your chamber hangs a picture of one whom you never knew, but whom you have long held in tenderest regard, and who was painted for you by a friend of mine, the Knight of Plympton. She communes with you. She smiles on you. When your spirits are low, her bright eyes shine on you and cheer you. Her innocent sweet smile is a caress to you. She never fails to soothe you with her speechless prattle. You love her. She is alive with you. As you extinguish your candle and turn to sleep, though your eyes see her not, is she not there still smiling? as you lie in the night awake, and thinking of your duties, and the morrow's inevitable toil oppressing the busy, weary, wakeful brain as with a remorse, the crackling fire flashes up for a moment in the grate, and she is there, your little bodious maiden, smiling with her sweet eyes. When moon is down, when fire is out, when curtains are drawn, when lids are closed, is she not there, the little beautiful one, though invisible, present and smiling still? Friend, the unseen ones are round about us. Does it not seem as if the time were drawing near when it shall be given to men to behold them? The print of which my friend spoke, and which, indeed, hangs in my room, though he has never been there, is that charming little winter piece of Sir Joshua, representing the little Lady Caroline Montagu, afterwards Duchess of Buccleuch. She is represented as standing in the midst of a winter landscape, wrapped in muff and cloak, and she looks out of her picture with a smile so exquisite that a Herod could not see her without being charmed. I beg your pardon, Mr. Pinto, I said to the person with whom I was conversing. I wonder, by the way, that I was not surprised at his knowing how fond I am of this print. Who spoke of the Knight of Plympton? Sir Joshua died, 1792. And you say he was your dear friend? As I spoke, I chanced to look at Mr. Pinto, and then it suddenly struck me. Gracious powers! Perhaps you are 100 years old, now I think of it. You look more than 100. Yes, you may be 1,000 years old for what I know. Your teeth are false. One eye is evidently false. Can I say that the other is not? If a man's age may be calculated by the rings round his eyes, this man may be as old as Methuselah. He has no beard. He wears a large curly glossy brown wig, and his eyebrows are painted a deep olive green. It was odd to hear this man, this walking mummy, talking sentiment, in these queer old chambers in Shepherd's Inn. Pinto passed a yellow bandana handkerchief over his awful white teeth, and kept his glass eye steadily fixed on me. Joshua's friend? Said he, you perceive, eluding my direct question, it's not everyone that knows his pictures Reynolds's friend? Suppose I tell you that I have been in his painting room scores of times, and that his sister Tee has made me tea, and his sister Toffee has made coffee for me? You will only say I am an old humbug. Mr. Pinto, I remarked, spoke all languages with an accent equally foreign. Suppose I tell you that I knew Mr. Sam Johnson, and did not like him? That I was at that very ball at Madame Cornelis's, which you have mentioned in one of your little, what do you call them? Bah, my memory begins to fail me in one of your little whirligig papers. Suppose I tell you that Sir Joshua has been here, in this very room? Have you, then, had these apartments for more than 70 years? I asked. They look as if they had not been swept for that time, don't they? Hey? I did not say that I had them for 70 years, but that Sir Joshua has visited me here. When? I asked, eyeing the man sternly, for I began to think he was an impostor. He answered me with a glance still more stern, colon, Sir Joshua Reynolds was here this very morning, with Angelica Kaufman and Mr. Oliver Goldschmidt. He is still very much attached to Angelica, who still does not care for him. Because he is dead, and I was in the fourth morning coach at his funeral, is that any reason why he should not come back to earth again? My good sir, you are laughing at me. He has sat many a time on that very chair which you are occupying. There are several spirits in the room now, whom you cannot see. Excuse me. Here he turned round, as if he was addressing somebody, and began rapidly speaking a language unknown to me. Tea is Arabic, he said. A bad patois I own. I learned it in Barbary, when I was a prisoner amongst the Moors. In anno 1609 Binik Aldus Geklet Gegen. Ha! You doubt me. Look at me well. At least I am like, perhaps some of my readers, remember a paper of which the figure of a man carrying a barrel formed the initial letter, asterisk, and which I copied from an old spoon now in my possession. As I looked at Mr. Pinto, I do declare he looked so like the figure on that old piece of plate, that I started and felt very uneasy. Eh? said he, laughing through his false teeth. I declare they were false. I could see utterly toothless gums working up and down behind the pink coral. You see, I wore a beard then. I am shaved now. Perhaps you think I am a spoon. Ha, ha. And as he laughed, he gave a cough which I thought would have coughed his teeth out, his glass eye out, his wig off, his very head off. But he stopped this convulsion by stumping across the room and seizing a little bottle of bright pink medicine, which, being opened, spread a singular acrid aromatic odor through the apartment. And I thought I saw, but of this, I cannot take an affirmation. A light green and violet flame flickering round the neck of the phial as he opened it. By the way, from the peculiar stumping noise which he made in crossing the bare boarded apartment, I knew at once that my strange entertainer had a wooden leg. Over the dust which lay quite thick on the boards, you could see the mark of one foot very neat and pretty, and then a round O, which was naturally the impression made by the wooden stump. I own I had a queer thrill as I saw that mark, and felt a secret comfort that it was not cloven. Asterisk this refers to an illustrated edition of the work. In this desolate apartment in which Mr. Pinto had invited me to see him, there were three chairs, one bottomless, a little table on which you might put a breakfast tray, and not a single other article of furniture. In the next room, the door of which was open, I could see a magnificent gilt dressing case, with some splendid diamond and ruby shirt studs lying by it, and a chest of drawers, and a cupboard apparently full of clothes. Remembering him in Baden-Baden in great magnificence, I wondered at his present denuded state. Who have a house elsewhere, Mr. Pinto? I said. Many, says he, have apartments in many cities. I lock them up, and do not carry much logish. I then remembered that his apartment at Baden, where I first met him, was bare, and had no bed in it. There is, then, a sleeping room beyond? This is the sleeping room. He pronounces it this. Can this, by the way, give any clue to the nationality of this singular man? If you sleep on these two old chairs, you have a rickety couch. If on the floor, a moldy one. Suppose I sleep up here? Said this strange man, and he actually pointed up to the ceiling. I thought him mad, or what he himself called an ombog. No. You do not believe me. For why should I deceive you? I came but to propose a matter of business to you. I told you I could give you the clue to the mystery of the two children in black, whom you met at Baden, and you came to see me. If I told you, you would not believe me. What for try and convince you? Ha, hey? And he shook his hand once, twice, thrice, at me, and glared at me out of his eye in a peculiar way. Of what happened now I protest I cannot give an accurate account. It seemed to me that there shot a flame from his eye into my brain, whilst behind his glass eye there was a green illumination, as if a candle had been lit in it. It seemed to me that from his long fingers two quivering flames issued, sputtering, as it were, which penetrated me, and forced me back into one of the chairs, the broken one out of which I had much difficulty in scrambling, when the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.